What stops me being awake and free? The question only really makes sense as an alive question. That means as a question that's directed right now to my experience. In other words, what right now seems to be in the way of this possibility for freedom? So I'd encourage you, in order that it's an alive question, to keep the aliveness of it in mind as I share some reflections. So that as much as possible, these reflections aren't just offered in the abstract, but are applied to our own kind of living reality. That they're not questions to apply next time we go on retreat, not questions to apply when we get home. Although that too. But rather ways ongoingly to check out the signals where we notice some shrinking, some contracting, some compulsion, some unfree movement, in other words. If what we're interested in is freedom of being, then slightly conversely maybe to what we might think, what we really need to be interested in is everything that presents as unfree. That's what liberation is, the liberating of the unfree. And we get to meet that by noticing where I feel unfree, where I feel pinched, where I feel caught, where I feel compromised, where I feel confused, where I feel conflicted. Lots of C's in there. Contracted, confused, conflicted, compelled. We don't get to freedom of being through trying to kind of imagine ourselves there, by trying to put on a facade of Buddhist peacefulness and niceness non-attachedness, then we end up with a facsimile of freedom. We get there through the courage and the willingness to face those places that feel unfree, that feel stuck. And in recognizing what's stuck about them, what's unfree, how come I get caught up here again and again and again? The willingness to meet that and kind of shine the light of awareness there is what allows it to start to reveal more of itself, start to kind of allows the heart to crack open there. So some reflections then on some of what we could call misunderstandings, really. Misunderstandings about life, or even misunderstandings about this kind of practice that seem to get in the way. Abiding freely with life. Firstly, really just the idea, the fixation on all the things, anything at all, anything that you can acquire, any experience you can have, any place you could be, any body you could be with, any fixation on what it would be that would make you happy. You can be sure that isn't it. It doesn't mean that it might not be very worthwhile and valid and valuable and maybe even important to pursue in some way that person, that place, that experience, that situation. But to the extent that we isolate, as we do many, many times a day, in small ways, in subtle ways, to the extent that we isolate something with our mantra of if only. If only I had that. If only I got this. If only I was with that person. If only this would stop happening. If only that would start happening. If only, you can fill in your own dotted line, if only, dot, 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 everything would be okay. And as we know from millions of repeated experiences, it won't be okay. Never has been ever all okay, never will be all okay. In some ways, a very simple message, one that's easy to recognize the truth of. Nobody ever managed to get some thing, some experience, some person in such a way that made everything happily ever after. Right? It's clearly just the provenance of fairy tales. And yet, how many times a day, even if we wouldn't philosophically think that, how many times a day do we viscerally fall under that spell? If this, then everything would be okay. If only my knees weren't hurting, then I'd really be a top meditator. So to fall under the spell of if only is to contract our being, to contract our possibility for freedom of being, and put it onto one thing, one place, one situation, one experience, which can never fulfill that for us. It might be fleetingly sweet, pleasant, beautiful even, but the key is in the fleeting. And then we rear back in the cycle. Something else, if only. Something else. So even though that's one of the most simple truths, and anybody who's had even a cursory exposure to this kind of practice and these teachings will be very familiar with that teaching of the kind of a futility of desire as an attempt to really get true happiness. Nevertheless, the simplicity of it is beguiling in some way, because that's a practice that asks us to look again and again and again and again and again at what am I fixating on. Ideas of right and wrong seem to really get in the way of freedom of being. I'll explain what I mean by that, because they can that sense of that right and wrong can easily get confused as if I'm advocating a kind of lack of any moral code. But that's not what I mean. I'm trying to explain. Feeling right gets in our way of meeting life freely. Feeling righteous. All the struggles in life, all the misery in life, all the conflict that we feel with others because we're so sure we're right. Any kind of conflict with others, usually somewhere in there's a sense that I'm right and that therefore they're wrong. And the hurt and the resentment and the hatred, if we're honest, and if we look at seeing what's happened in the heart, that can come out of that sense of feeling right as opposed to wrong. We may be in some way right, but in any conflict, as right as I feel, the other person feels equally right. If they didn't, there wouldn't be any conflict. I say, I'm right, and they say, yes, it's true, you're right. That's the end of it. That's not conflict. Conflict is where I say, I'm right, and they say, no, I'm right. And as deeply as I know how right I am, they know how right they are just as clearly as me. Where does that leave us for dealing with the trickiness of meeting someone freely? We can't meet someone freely when we see them as wrong. It's very tricky territory, that whole right and wrong. And yet, in a way, the whole basis of compassion, real, not the kind of, trying to be nice, but that real compassion, is the recognition that everybody's doing their best. Everybody wants to love and be loved. Everybody wants to be happy and peaceful. Even this guy who thinks he's right when I know he's wrong. I'm not pointing at anyone. And so the willingness to meet someone freely is to see past the posture that we've both gotten into. The feeling right is a very isolating experience. The sense of self, we feel very much apart from the other. And maybe if we really notice what's going on, we feel apart from even in a whole wider sense. It's like it's me against the world, almost. And in fact, we could say there's always some degree of me against the world. Apart from, if we're really abiding in a way that's awake and free, if we're really freely meeting life, there's no need to take a posture, a position. There's no need to stand against or stand apart from. We may have different views. We may have irreconcilably different views. But as right as my view feels to me, so that person's view feels to them. It's not even that all views are equal. That would be too much. If you're familiar with Wilbur, we could say that would be flatland. If that'll make sense to some, if it doesn't, it doesn't matter. But the kind of tendency to make all things equal in a way that's too extreme. Some views might well be more right than others in an absolute sense, but this isn't an absolute sense, this is a human sense. I feel right, he or she feels right. And to meet that person freely is to recognize that, basically. To recognize that, they're right for where they're at. And understanding that allows us to meet that freely. I don't know what the response will be, but there's no response possible when I'm in the traction of feeling I'm right and they're right. All there is banging up against each other. So it takes courage to let go of our righteousness. It takes humility to not rely on that kind of entrenched position. It takes wisdom to be able to see somebody through the view they hold. To see their own, they're just like me, their own insecurity, their own wish to find the truth of things, their own doing their best to have a sense of how things are. So when we're in conflict in some way, and when we feel that certainty of being right, and often a kind of heat that goes with it, the heat of right, the anger of right, the righteousness, the entrenched positionality of right, there's an invitation to actually investigate that as my rightness. The idea that maybe my sense of rightness is what's standing in the way of meeting this situation freely, meeting this person freely, being here freely. We tend to just focus on how their sense of right is what's standing in the way of this happening freely. But even if that's true, what can we do? What can we do about their sense of right except argue and harangue? Which doesn't often change the views. And it's just with the election at the moment, plenty of chance to see the slinging around of entrenched views. So there's kind of a revolution in terms of a turning around of approach to be willing to focus when we feel caught by right, heated up by right, reactive by feeling right. To be willing to investigate, what am I propping up? What am I getting tight around? What am I getting hot about? What am I reacting to? that's not so much about the other person and their view, but it's more about maybe my need to be right. Similarly, feeling wrong really gets in the way of our capacity to meet life freely. And it's a curse for us, the curse of feeling wrong, which might show up in many different guises: feeling wrong, feeling not good enough, I've done it wrong, I look wrong, I feel wrong, I am wrong. And the pressure that builds up then, and how I could be or should be different than that. One of the most freeing understandings in this practice is the real recognition that there's no wrong feeling. There's nothing you shouldn't feel. There's nothing that needs, no inner experience that needs to be rejected or not allowed. There's plenty of ways of acting out some of those feelings, which might really be better to be censored. Right? But the way things get acted out is a whole different thing. But there's nothing that's not okay to arrive in consciousness. There's no way, in fact, we could say, to be wrong in terms of having human experience. It's very, very difficult for us to really go very far in freeing up our life if we're constantly hijacking the process by telling ourselves, I'm wrong, I'm doing it wrong, I'm feeling something that's wrong, I'm having an experience that's wrong. And that's, like I say, like a curse that runs through our life. And certainly, if it's running through the rest of our life, it just runs through our meditation practice as well. The sense that I'm doing it wrong. My meditation isn't good enough. I look around the room, everybody else seems to be right. But somehow I feel like I'm doing it wrong. And it takes a lot of skill, actually. It usually takes a lot of time to really kind of undo that inner sense of wrongness. But I mention it now, just the small time I have to give attention to this. I teach a whole week-long retreat every summer just on this aspect of the tendency to hijack our own inner process by, through self-criticism, self-hatred, self-doubt, self-destruction almost. But I mention it now just in this brief way, just to open the possibility that when that idea is there, I'm wrong. Wrong about my practice, wrong about the way I'm meeting someone, the idea that others are going to see me as somehow wrong, the way I'm measuring myself as wrong. Just to open a crack of possibility, to see that that sense has no truth to it. It's just an accumulated idea that hijacks our well-being. There's no way to be wrong. There's no wrong experience. To the extent that we start to recognize that, to that extent, there's so much more space in our hearts, more space in our inner life, for whatever might start to show up. Actually, when we're not pushing great chunks of our experience away as being wrong, there's much, much less compulsion to act them out, to follow through on them. because they're just seen as the surprise of the moment, the movement of the moment. There's this lovely story Ram Dass tells, if you haven't heard of, is a kind of much-loved American teacher who was a Harvard professor and then spent many, many years in India, and now he's quite old and lives in Hawaii. And I once heard him say, after 35 years of meditation and yoga and fasting and studying psychology and having therapy and all this great long catalogue of things, he said, I don't think I've gotten rid of any one of my neuroses. And then he said, but they're just not the monsters they used to be anymore. He said, now I see them come along. I say, oh, hi. Oh, sexual perversity. Hi. And I thought it was really beautiful, the free meeting, the free expression, the free way. He says, oh, yeah, some sexually perverse thought arises. Oh, hi. No, anything's welcome. Anything might arise. And it's a very different process when we're not judging it for being wrong, judging ourselves for being wrong, measuring ourselves against some crazy ideal of how we ought to be. It's very hard to free up our life when we're measuring it against an idea. I ought to be more mindful. I ought to be more compassionate. My meditation ought to be better. That doesn't sound very free. What a tragedy to undertake this practice of freedom and awakening, only to use it as a stick to beat ourselves with for being so unfree and so unawake. If we were wrong, we wouldn't be here. There's something most fundamentally confirming in just the very fact of this. Body, heart, mind, consciousness, and this mysterious, extraordinary participation in life. The very fact of this aliveness is an extraordinary affirmation. And it has room for anything. And so, the moment we call that wrong, and therefore unacceptable, and therefore something I have to kind of push away from me, reject, get rid of, suppress, ignore, deny, escape from, that causes a painful split off from our life. That causes us to feel divided from ourselves, to feel unfree. So just to be clear, there's plenty of behaviours, plenty of actions that we might really want to ignore for our own safety and well-being and for the safety and well-being of others. But there's nothing that happens in consciousness that shouldn't be happening. And the willingness to turn a kind of gentle, permissive, allowing regard to whatever arises is what allows us to meet it freely without it getting a kind of obsessive grip on us. Another kind of, I think, something else that gets in the way, particularly if you're, as many, most of you are, fairly kind of experienced in and committed to this kind of practice, is some kind of trying to disappear. Some sense of trying to kind of meditate our life away. Which sounds tragic, but we have to see for ourselves if there's some element of trying to kind of escape, get out of, get away from. I remember one of my teachers once telling me that meditation practice and in fact the Dharma practice in general, should always be dynamic. Should always be dynamic. And I wonder, sometimes I really wonder, as I sit and meditate with a room full of people, how much dynamism might be going on, and how much withdrawal. How much there's some kind of overlay of an idea of trying to disappear, trying to go to get peaceful, you might call it, or trying to get quiet. Sometimes people say to me, oh, sometimes I had this meditation and I got really quiet. As if that's a really successful meditation. And then other meditation where I wasn't quiet, then that's unsuccessful. That sounds more like sleep than meditation. Sometimes there are moments in meditation that might feel profoundly quiet, still. But along with the quality of real quiet and peace and stillness is integrally bound up with that is a sense of vibrancy, aliveness, a kind of vibrancy that life has. So if our practice is an alive one, and a one that's about being awake and free, we don't disappear in that. But often there's some kind of co-opting, I think, of teachings about not-self, combined with some degree of discomfort, which is we all come to practice like this because of some discomfort with life of self and how we are and how we show up in the world and how it's hard to tolerate that. There's some co-opting of that with teachings of not-self into some effort to disappear, to fade, to dissolve. It even starts to sound very spiritual as to dissolve into nothing. That's not. Now, if you think about the individuals who have most inspired you, think about the teachers that you've most appreciated, whether meeting or reading, do they seem like they just dissolve? Or do they seem to be pretty big and vibrant and vivid characters? So that sense of vividness is much more aligned with awake and free than a sense of disappeared or dissolved. That our own inner life can become more and more vivid. That our own sense of life around us and that our sense of our interpenetration with life becomes more and more vivid. That what's happening stands out more and more clearly. What's happening here, what's happening here, and what's happening in the interchange in this here. So we might ask ourselves if maybe something that's standing in the way of being awake and free is some actually moving in an opposite direction. Not to things standing out more and more clearly, but to actually things getting more and more vague. Is our meditation in some way an attempt to disappear? To get comfortably numb? Not philosophically. No one would say, oh, I've come along to here today to try and get comfortably numb. Come here to just disappear into a kind of vague soup. But sometimes, and I certainly recognize this from my own practice, did recognize this at the point when I heard this, my practice should always be dynamic, vivid. That even though in theory my intention is to be awake and free, in practice sometimes I just want to kind of get through in some kind of comfortable way. So that orientation, I think, towards dynamism, vividness, things standing out more and more, is very important. In terms of meditation practice, it might feel more comfortable to go vague, but it isn't of much use to us. of much more use to be conscious of discomfort than be unconscious in comfort. And that's the kind of emphasis of our practice that might somehow, you know, stick a rocket. I won't go on with that. That might motivate us, let's say. Sometimes when people say, "Oh, I feel my practice is a bit dull, and I want to, you know, motivate. I want to inspire. I want to, you know, get into it a bit more." On a retreat, maybe. So I say, "Okay, well, sleep less." This is one of the, again, advice I got: sleep less, eat less, sit more. And then suddenly, all the wish for that inspiration and motivation dissolves. Very hit that. No, I want a comfortable way to liven up my practice. So just to see if we can orientate towards dynamism. And even the process of feeling stuck. Sometimes we feel like nothing's happening in practice. I feel stuck. Even that can be dynamic. Let yourself really feel the sense of stuckness. To connect with stuckness, even stuckness is a dynamic process. Oh. It goes like this. This is a movement in the feeling of stuckness. The movement is the sense of wanting to go forward and of something holding that back. And if you let yourself move into that impact between some kind of urgency around getting somewhere and some sense of limitation around not getting somewhere, then that makes the process very alive. Whereas if you feel, "Oh, I'm stuck," and you wait for something to happen. So I just kind of meditate, go through the motions until something happens. There's a kind of deadening aspect there. That's why I was putting the emphasis on this morning on the standing up when there's dullness in the mind. And committing to dynamism, that our practice be alive, that we're really supporting awakening, not just as an idea, but by being wakeful with what's happening. And that may be uncomfortable in some ways, but it's one of the things that really starts to open things up. Doesn't mean we have to go and look for discomfort. Doesn't mean we have to go and discard our meditation cushions and sit on a hard floor so as to really that kind of gung-ho way of practicing. It's actually also valid for some time, but usually if we do that, we find that along with the gung-ho-ness and the benefits that can be there is also a kind of harsh edge. And so that's the counterpoint to dynamism, is the willingness to be gentle. It's the counterpoint to the feeling wrong that I spoke about earlier as well. The intention to be gentle, developing the capacity to be gentle. Remember, sometimes it's just as simple as remembering to be gentle with ourselves. And for some people, maybe even just talking about awake and free is missing the big part. You might say awake and free and gentle. Holding ourselves gently, holding our experience gently, holding our various inner movements and whatever we're noticing gently, allowing our experience to show up, allowing ourselves to meet what's happening, however it is. is a line. I'm not sure who first came up with it. It may have been Jack Kornfield. It says something about, don't be a Buddhist, be a Buddha. I think that points to one of the other misunderstandings that can often get in the way of an authentic practice of awakening and freeing up our relationship with life, is having some idea of what that ought to look like. That it ought to look like what it looks like for other people. That it ought to look like some kind of like the values or the qualities that we see reflected by a tradition or by a teacher. I was talking about the kind of vividness that we feel inspired by, and yet there seems to be some overlay, particularly in Buddhism, maybe particularly in certain ends of Buddhism, which this end of this tradition's in, of the emphasis on the beautiful qualities, wisdom, compassion, sensitivity, kindness, etc. And then trying to fit ourselves into that mould. Trying to, in other words, be a Buddhist rather than a Buddha. Trying to fit our experience into some idea of what it looked like, should look like, rather than being true to the way it is. And it's interesting that the Buddha's own life and experience was that he had a couple of teachers himself that were both very influential on him. And he practiced with them for some time, and he was grateful to them, but there was something missing. And ultimately, having benefited greatly from his teachers, he nevertheless kind of found his own way, his own expression. And so the message, in some way we quite might see, the message of the Buddha's teaching is, at least as far as it was for him, one has to find one's own way. But of course, because of that tendency I just spoke about, the message becomes, I have to do it the Buddha's way. There's a great difference between doing it someone else's way and finding your own way. And in the end, we have to find our own way. We're each of us a unique kind of configuration of body, heart, mind, personality, feeling, history, and the way all of that shows up. That's kind of obvious, right? And yet, how much we try to fit our experience into a certain template. If there was a certain template, then all liberated people would just be like automatons, all exactly the same. And we might notice that. We might notice that if we meet a teacher, for example, that we're trying to kind of compare them to our ideal of how they should show up. And they usually find them lacking. Or we might initially feel inspired when they just kind of breeze in, meditate a bit, dispense some wisdom and breeze out again. But then we see them, eating sloppily, or I don't know what it might be. That's not what a Buddhist ought to look like. Well, that's not what somebody with some wisdom ought to look like. The process of actually trusting our own experience is very much the process of freeing up our relationship with life. And I don't know, I have no idea how your life ought to free up and what that might look like. I don't have a great deal of idea about how that happens here. In fact, I would say probably 20 years on, of being involved in this practice pretty intensively, have less and less idea of what it ought to look like. Less and less idea of what the practice ought to look like, and less and less idea of what the expression ought to look like. But along with the less and less idea seems to be more and more authenticity. And authenticity, which is maybe a synonym for a free relationship with life, doesn't come from trying to conform to an idea. So that is both scary and exciting. Scary because part of us just wants to be able to rely on a template. It's again a bit that wants to just be comfortable rather than doing our own confronting, destabilizing, shake-upping work of, you know, of deconstructing a familiar sense of self to allow for a more full and free relationship. Exciting because it means, so scary because of that confrontation, but exciting because it means we don't need to rely on a template. We don't need to look like anybody else. We don't need the content of our meditation. We don't need the content of our minds. We don't need what we do or how we do it or how we show up to conform to a fixed idea of what a free life looks like, what an awake life looks like. Measure it, if we measure it really in terms of, well, we measure it, what's that last line by Christ? You'll know them by their fruits. Is that a real line or if I misquoted? Something like that. Okay, we'll go with that. So we know freedom and awakening by its fruits, not by its conformity to an idea. The fruits of deepening sensitivity to life, deepening ease of being, deepening wellness in our skin, which is a kind of poor translation from a French phrase, but deepening sense of the free feeling of being here, a deepening sense of okayness with life, a deepening sensitivity to what's going on here, a deepening capacity to actually respond to people, to situations, a deepening capacity to tolerate ourselves. And even though that might sound like a strange turn of phrase, it doesn't sound like a great achievement to just about manage to tolerate myself. But actually, when we see how intolerant we are of ourselves, we recognize what an enormous freedom it is to be able to not just tolerate ourselves, but actually have plenty of room for ourselves. Plenty of room for this heart and our body and mind and feelings and thoughts to be here, to show up, to not be made wrong, to not be pushed away. So I really invite you to use whatever supports really feel useful. And there may be the supports of teachers, it may be the supports of teachings, it may be the supports for a particular tradition. It may be that our really finding our own way and our own authentic expression might happen while adhering quite strongly and uniquely to one particular type of path of practice. It might be. Or it might be that we kind of use whatever works for us where we find it. But in a way, here's where the work happens. Here's where our freedom gets worked out or discovered in the life of our own heart, in the life of our own consciousness. And you're the one who knows that life most intimately. You're the one who can listen to this heart most closely. You're the one who can respond to yourself most bestly. And And that's what this practice is an invitation to. That's what being awake means. Awake to ourselves. Awake to life. That's what a free relationship means. It's not very free to try and be like somebody else or like our ideal for ourselves. And the fact of being conscious is life inviting us into this free relationship. Inviting us into its embrace. Life is embracing us. Here we are, held up in life, supported in life, made conscious by life, given breath by life, given emotional sensitivity by life. Here we are, just finding ourselves here. Well, there's not much we can say about here, other than it's always here, and it's right in the middle of life. Look, we're right in the middle of life. So our own sensitivity, our own inner work, our own willingness to meet what shows up, is how we recognize that invitation more and more clearly. How we show up more and more freely. How we're more and more available to ourselves and what's going on. More and more available to others and the meeting that can happen there. More and more available to life as an awake, free expression. We are an expression of life's freeness and our most fundamental. This is our invitation. And our practice is coming to the party. So it's my sincere hope that our practice here together today, and that the goodness of that, and the sincerity with which you each kind of meet your own inner life, is a support for waking up, support for meeting life in a way that's free beyond our imagination. Beyond imagination, because we can only imagine based on what we've already known. Right? We can't imagine a colour we've never seen. We can't imagine a fruit we've never the taste of a fruit we've never tasted. Imagination runs out at that point. Similarly, we can't imagine a freedom of being beyond that which we've ever experienced. So don't try to imagine. Don't try to come up with an idea. Meet what's here. Allow what's here. Respond to what's here. Come back to what's here. Sitting, walking, working, resting, loving, arguing, whatever you're doing. And surely, surely, you'll find yourself more and more awake, more and more free, more and more responsive, more and more here.